studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. One quiet summer evening last June, my wife and I explored the Petersburg, Virginia battlefield. It was hard to even conceive of the violence that took place in this lovely expanse of green. There's one spot on the battlefield in which the grass slopes down into a smooth but pronounced crater. This crater was caused when, on July 30th, 1864, Union troops blew a giant hole in the ground under the Confederate troops. What transpired in the Battle of the Crater is one of the most infamous battles of the Civil War. Historian and novelist Richard Slotkin has written a book about it called No Quarter, The Battle of the Crater, 1864. And I invited him to discuss it with us tonight. Richard Slotkin, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Slotkin, where in the Civil War chronology did this battle occur?
This occurs in the, really it's in the last year of the war, the last year of open campaigning. It's the height of the campaign in which Grant took the Army of the Potomac all the way down from Washington to lay siege to Petersburg, which is the supply nexus through which the Confederate capital of Richmond was supplied.
And whose idea was it to crater and to mine, I guess, dig a big tunnel and put some explosives in there?
Well, that's one of the most interesting things about it. You have to imagine, I don't know if people know anything about the Civil War battles, but this battlefield looks more like World War One than it looks like Gettysburg. So you've got trench lines, which under the technological conditions of the time, you could not really carry by direct assault. The artillery just simply wasn't powerful enough to blow a hole. So what happened was there was a regiment of coal miners. They had the regiment, a volunteer regiment, had been raised in Schuylkill County in Pennsylvania, which is a big coal mining district. They were at a point in the lines where there was only 100 yards between their forward positions and a Confederate strong point. So the private soldiers got the idea of tunneling under the 100 yards of no man's land, filling the end of the tunnel with gunpowder and blowing up the Confederate fort. And once you do that, the fact that your artillery is too weak doesn't matter, because you've put they were going to put 8,000 pounds of gunpowder under that one point in the Confederate lines. And so the coal miners got the idea, and it happened that their colonel was a mining engineer who had specialized in digging long-distance tunnels, and he proceeded largely on his own hook to dig what was then the longest military tunnel that had ever been dug.
How long exactly was it?
Something a little over 511 feet. They had to start in a sort of ravine somewhat behind their own front line in order to have the mine head concealed from the Confederates on the other side. So it was about 511 feet long.
So
the problem with that is that it's very hard to ventilate a tunnel like that, and this mining engineer had a very ingenious device for clearing the bad air out of the tunnel.
What was this? What was this device?
What he did was he built a wooden tube into the tunnel, and he built a fire at the mouth of the tunnel to create a convection current, and then by opening and closing curtains within the mine, he could create a suction either through the tube into the open air, or if he needed to pull more air out, he would suck the fresh air in through the tube and the bad air out through the big space.
It's interesting how war is the mother of invention, so often.
Well, yeah.
So they dug this great big tunnel, and the Confederates were completely unaware that this was happening?
No, they figured it out in fairly short order, because with all the precautions that the Union soldiers took, they were still aware that the precautions were being taken, that things weren't happening that should have been happening, and a very good artillery officer on the other side figured it out. But what you have to do when you know that somebody is mining under your lines, you have to dig what are called countermines. So the Confederates start digging their own tunnels on their side of the line, sort of probing through the ground, trying to hit the Union tunnel before it could reach their lines. And they never succeeded in doing it.
Well, before we go on with this story, which is a fascinating one, you also mentioned how much it looks like World War One, and it really does. You know, the way that it's been maintained with those trenches. And if you've ever been, if our listeners have ever been to Belgium and visited the trenches of death that are still on display there, it really looks exactly like that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I believe there's a trench. There's a crater, a big crater somewhere in France where the same thing happened.
Oh, yeah. It's a standard technique of siege warfare. Shakespeare even refers to it in the famous phrase, the engineer hoist with his own petard. The petard is the explosive charge at the end of the mine. So it goes way back.
Interesting. So they dig this wonderful little tunnel and they blow up. When did they actually fire the thing off?
Well, they fired it on the 30th of July, but it took them really more than a month to, almost 2 months to dig it. And it wasn't enough simply to blow a hole in the line. You had to also plan very carefully for an infantry assault to exploit the breach in the line once you'd blown the big hole. So the general who was in charge of that particular section of the trenches, a guy named Ambrose Burnside, also put together a plan for the infantry assault. Now, Burnside, who's one of the most weirdest combination of ingenuity and stupidity that you can possibly imagine, he starts out very well. He supports this mining operation, which the army engineers think is basically impossible to do. They've never seen anything that long. And he also decides that he's going to use as his assault troops his black division. The 9th Army Corps, which he commanded, had the only division of African-American troops in the Army of the Potomac, which is the main Union Army in the Northeast. And it's the largest black military formation in American history to that time, and actually the largest up until World War One.
Now, hadn't both sides agreed previous to this not to use African-American soldiers?
No, the big breach in the revolutionary change that came with the Emancipation Proclamation Lincoln gave in 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation specifically said that black troops shall be raised and that Union officers shall raise no objections and put no impediments in the way of enlisting black troops.
I see.
So by the summer of 1864, this is more than a year after Fort Wagner and the famous charge of the 54th Massachusetts. This, at this point, nearly one out of every 11 soldiers in arms for the Union is black.
I see.
They're not using them in combat roles much, but in this arm, this is a combat army. This is not a garrison army, so this is a division of black troops that is available for use in combat. And the other divisions in this Army Corps had really been ripped apart in the heavy fighting that they'd done on the campaign that took them from Washington to Petersburg. So Burnside said, you know, these guys, my white troops are basically gun-shy. As soon as a cannon is fired at them, they're going to go to ground. They're not going to charge. I need troops that are too new to combat to know how bad it can be. And that's the black troops, because they hadn't seen much combat. And he gives them special training, because the maneuvers going through the trench lines are very complicated. And if you don't practice it, you're liable to become tremendously confused. So the black troops are given training specifically for this assault, so that they will not be confused by the process of getting out of their own lines, which is very difficult, or by the difficulty of getting around this huge hole in the ground that the explosion is going to make.
Well, hang on just a second. I want everybody to know that, if they're just joining us, that we're talking with Richard Slotkin, and he's written this book called No Quarter, The Battle of the Crater. He's also written the novels Crater, a novel of the Civil War, The Return of Henry Starr, and Abe, a novel of young Lincoln. So they've got this big tunnel, and they blow it up, and they've got troops that aren't afraid to march into cannon fire. So everything must have gone perfectly according to plan. It must have ended the war right there.
Well, it should have, but then politics intervened. And the most critical thing which happened was that when General Meade, who was Burnside's superior, commanding the Army of the Potomac under General Grant, who's the overall commander of the Union armies, General Meade takes a look at the battle plan. He sees that black troops are in front, and he says, this can't happen. And there are two reasons. The one that he admits to is that it's politically explosive. He's afraid if they send the black troops in and the battle is a disaster, he'll be blamed for sacrificing the black troops. But the second thing is he also doesn't believe that black troops can fight. So he changes Burnside's plan about 36 hours before the battle is supposed to occur. He takes out the one division that's trained to do it, and he says, you can use any one of your other divisions. You can't use this specially trained black division. At this point, Burnside goes into a funk, and his stupid button takes over, and he can't decide which of his other divisions to give the leading assignment to. So he has them draw straws. He has the other three generals draw straws for the assignment. And as luck would have it, the straw is drawn by a guy named General James Ledlie, whose way of dealing with the stress of combat is to get literally falling down blackout drunk.
That's a good strategy.
And somehow this has been covered up by the man's staff. The word has not gotten through to Burnside. So he gives the assault the key assignment to this guy Ledlie. Ledlie's orders are: when the mine explodes, you take your division, you charge through the hole, and you take the high ground on the other side. Ledlie tells his brigadiers, the mine goes off, just go into the mine and hold it. So he gave false orders to his men. He changed the orders, either because he was drunk or because he was so panicked by the whole responsibility of leading the assault that he never really understood his assignment. In any case, what he did was a criminal offense, and it basically wrecks the battle plan. Mine goes off. Ledlie's troops in the front line are completely disorganized because they weren't prepared for the mine to explode. It's a huge explosion. It's the biggest explosion that human beings had ever made to that point. By the time they recover, they charge into the crater, and they think they're supposed to stay there. So they pile into this hole in the ground, which is 130 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 30 feet deep with sheer sides. Once you go in there, you're there.
How could you get out?
You can't. There's only two ways out, and there's sort of shallow ends where it connected with the old trench line. But immediately, those two points become totally impacted with troops. And instead of a charge through the hole in the line, you've got the division that's supposed to advance sitting on the only access routes that go to either side of the crater. Nobody can get through them to accomplish the mission. And Burnside just keeps telling everybody else, charge through the hole and take the high ground. Charge through the hole and take the high ground. He never goes to the front line to check.
He doesn't look at it.
His division commanders, with one exception, stay behind the line. Ledlie goes to a kind of a dugout behind the line and gets drunk. And these poor guys, the junior officers, and the brigade commanders, they do their best. They try to get their men to advance, but they don't really know what they're doing. They haven't been prepared for it, and there's a web of trenches behind the main line that's now full of Confederate infantry. Plus, the Confederates had established artillery batteries. They knew that the Union was coming. They had a circle of artillery batteries that was firing to keep the into the breach. So it's really a mess. And when things are finally just gone beyond recall, Burnside sends in the Black Division. And because they were so well trained, they're able to fight their way through their own troops, assemble on the other side, and attempt the assault on the high ground. They're stopped, and they're driven back by a Confederate counterattack. And at that point, it just dissolves. Everybody starts running back to the lines, except for the people who are trapped in the crater.
They're sitting ducks, I guess.
Yeah. And you get stuck in, and the troops that are stuck in the crater are stuck there for hours. No food, no water, 100-degree heat,
oh, God.
Constant bombardment. And Confederates attack, they're yelling, spare the white man, kill the nigger. And you get, at the end of the battle, you get a racial massacre combined with this terrible defeat. You get the Confederate troops killing the black troops. And you even get some Union soldiers to separate themselves from the blacks so that the Confederates won't kill them. They turn on their own black comrades in arms and start killing them.
Oh my God!
It's a horrific conclusion to the battle, and it ends essentially with a series of atrocities.
Where soldiers are surrendering and being killed anyway. And so
yeah. There's some of it's done in the heat of battle, and that happens. But many blacks who had surrendered and were being marched to the rear were also gunned down by Confederate troops in the rear.
Oh, gosh. But you're saying that Union troops were also killing their own...
And Union troops as well turned on their black fellow soldiers at several points in the position that they were defending.
We're speaking with historian Richard Slotkin, and his latest book is called No Quarter, The Battle of the Crater. So the battle was obviously a disaster. The war did not end, and things didn't go according to plan.
Yeah.
What were the ramifications?
Well, that was one of the curious things. You know, we're used to the way that the military operates now, both in terms of self-examination and in terms of military justice. But the Civil War, the investigation of this battle was essentially a scapegoating operation. They wanted to blame... They knew that Burnside had messed up, but they didn't want... But General Meade had also played a terrible role in the battle. I mentioned just the one thing he did, but he'd also handled it very badly from start to finish. But they weren't about to replace Meade, so that the court of inquiry that they held was essentially to exonerate Meade and to load it all on Burnside. And they also scapegoated the black troops for having supposedly run away and caused the defeat, which was a real libel on the black division. The black division did the most and the best fighting of any division on that day. They suffered 31% casualties, which was 10% more than any other division, and they also very nearly succeeded, despite everything, in accomplishing the mission. They did conduct a partly successful attack. Black troops also were among the ones who held out in the crater till the very end and kept that position going. So it was really in a kind of double sense a whitewash, in that it blamed the blacks and it loaded it all on Burnside. Ledlie, by the way, was allowed to resign. He was never penalized.
Well, if that occurred, this sort of whitewash that you're talking about, how were you able to reconstruct in such minute detail in your book the actual events and how they actually transpired?
Well, one of the things is that there's a tremendous amount of literature out there, both in print and even a lot of it online, produced by junior officers, regimental commanders, and private soldiers about their experiences in this battle. And if you put those kinds of documents together with the official record, the official reports also written by junior officers, you can get a sense of who went where and did what and when it happened. And if you kind of plot that out on a battle on a map, you begin to make some sense of what out of a battle that most historians really simply dismissed as a kind of stumblebum fiasco. And that was really what I had to do.
Well, and you did a fabulous job. It's amazing. Let me ask you what I think is kind of the larger question of it all. Do you feel that history glorifies the Civil War in some way to sort of disguise the blundering ineptitude of the United States in a war that, you know, they could have won easily and with far less death? Or is it that it was necessary to do it this way in order for the, you know, the war to be a symbol for the future of the nation, or what?
Well, I think that we do tend to glorify the Civil War and to gloss over the horror of that conflict, and in a way we fail to appreciate the courage and devotion of the soldiers who put up with conditions that are horrendous by modern standards. I mean, if you know you march into a battle in the Civil War as a frontline soldier with a 1 in 3 chance of getting shot, and you know you don't. It's not so easy to recover from those wounds without antiseptics, without antibiotics, under the hideous, filthy conditions of life in the trenches. So we've forgotten the squalor and the horror of it. For me, though, I think that the thing that we still underrate about the Civil War is the fact that it was that race was at the bottom of the conflict. And you know, you can talk about slavery and states' rights and so on, but when you get right down to it, what made soldiers on both sides, what gave them the rage that it took to deal with each other the way they did, had a lot to do with their ideas about race and the racial principles that they believed they were either defending or attacking. And certainly in this battle, race is really at the bottom of the horror of it.
Is that why you feel that this battle warrants the attention that you've given it?
Yeah, it does. I think, you know, there are technical things about it that might be of interest to a military specialist, but to a social historian, cultural historian, because this battle reveals just how powerful the racial feelings are on both sides, on all sides of the Civil War, and in battle the mask is taken off and you really see how these things work out.
And what is it, how do you think it relates to our current state of America? I mean, does it reflect on us in some way?
I think it does, in the sense that racial conflict and difficult grappling with the concept of race has always been a real problem for us. It isn't that long ago that half the nation was segregated, that blacks couldn't vote in many southern states, although things have changed immensely just in my lifetime. Race is still the key to a lot of what has happened in our past, and we forget that at our peril, because the feelings are there and they surface in strange ways.
Well, it's fascinating. The book is called No Quarter: The Battle of the Crater, and it really has very little to do with Led Zeppelin. Is that correct?
That's correct. Almost nothing, I would say, to do with Led Zeppelin.
Perhaps some of our listeners will read it anyway. But you've written quite a lot about American history, and what is your next? Where are you focusing next?
Well, I'm working on another book about the Battle of Antietam and the writing of the Emancipation Proclamation, and the way in which the politics around the Emancipation Proclamation affected military strategy in the battle.
Tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind. So, as I understand it, Lincoln wanted to use the Emancipation Proclamation, but he had to wait for a victory?
Yeah, he had to wait for a victory, and the real problem there is that the general who has to win the victory for him is, in effect, the leader of the opposition political party, General McClellan. And McClellan is a guy who is really, as a military leader, is a greater threat to the civilian government than any general in our history. I know that you know, Truman is praised for having fired General MacArthur threatening the civil-military balance, McClellan was a far greater threat than MacArthur ever was, and yet Lincoln had to depend on him to win this battle. So I'm trying to sort of tease out the interplay between the military decisions that Lincoln makes in regard to McClellan's appointment and how much power he gives him, and McClellan's plans to use his military successes politically.
When you're looking back at the history of the Civil War and in the depth that you do, do you ever just get angry and just get pissed off at these
guys? Yeah, I do. I get angry constantly. I would never want to write history that I didn't somehow identify with and care about. And the issues in the Civil War are so fundamental to the kind of country that we are. It's really the period that defined so much of what we think about government, about what democracy is, the meaning of equality, whether and who can be an American and what it means to be an American. That I just feel that when I work with the Civil War, that I'm working with the most basic stuff of American history and American identity.
The book is called No Quarter: The Battle of the Crater, and the author, the historian Richard Slotkin. Thank you so much for spending some time on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf, and I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back again next week for another good interview. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. See you next time.